Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. I'm your host, Tom Majeure. And today's program is the Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig. Welcome, Gary.
It's cold.
It's cold.
I want spring to come.
Okay. Well, you got a little ways to wait.
Yeah, but it's going to be better after December 21st. The days start getting longer.
That's right. That's right. And my co-host is Sue Majeure.
Oh, it's me again.
Okay. Welcome back after a month of absence.
Yes, I'm glad to be back. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we had to record at a time that she wasn't available, and so she missed the quiz, but she's going to make up for it this month.
We'll see.
Okay.
Gary, I will try.
Gary wouldn't even tip his hand. He didn't even give us any clues to what he's talking about, so there's no
preference. Not even a title.
Well, Sue, why don't you have a word of prayer, and we'll get started with the quiz, the mystery quiz.
Okay. Heavenly Father, thank you for this past growing season that we can look over it, see what we've learned, see what we've tried that has worked, things that we need to improve upon, how you've taught us again from what you have created this past year. And as we look forward excitedly to the new season that's coming up, the new things we can try, we'll learn about more things that you have created just for us, as you created us just for you. Help us to learn more about that as we go through this program. In your name, Jesus, amen.
Amen. We're going to have a quiz, but Gary, somewhere in there, I've got to talk about my apple cider experience.
So. Okay, we'll just throw it in.
Okay, but after the quiz.
All right, question number one. And about the first nine come from the Bible.
Okay.
Psalms 45:8 says, "All your garments are fragrant with myrrh and aloe and cassia. Out of ivory palaces, stringed instruments have made you glad."
I've heard that before.
What is cassia?
Okay, Sue.
It's a fragrance. I know in Job when it's some versions of the Bible, it's one of Job's new daughters. It's cassia, and it says, or a fragrance. So I'm thinking maybe it's one of those like frankincense or one of those natural, you know, type fragrances that they were able to get then.
With that in mind, is it possibly like a herb or something?
Well, what it actually is the inner bark of a tree that resembles cinnamon. So it looks like it might be in the cinnamon genus.
Okay. We're ready for number two.
All right. Number two is liquid myrrh, cinnamon, sweet-smelling cane, cassia, and olive oil were used to make what in the Bible?
All together?
Mm-hmm.
I think it sounds like some of the embalming spices that they used.
Not quite. It was the anointing oil used for the sanctuary. So when they dedicated the sanctuary, all of the utensils were anointed with this oil mixture, and even the priests were anointed with it.
So do you have a reference for our listeners if they want to follow up on that?
Actually, I didn't put that particular reference down, but I'll get it to you, Tom, so you can post it on your website. Most likely, it's fairly, I think I got this from the Psalms, but I'll have to double check. Then we're in Psalms 51:7 now, and this one is a little shorter. It's a fill in the blank. "Purify me with blank, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow." What plant completes the verse? Oh, you were good. Yep.
Hyssop.
Exactly. This one should be easy, too. It should be a no-brainer for you guys. This is from Luke 12:27. And Jesus said this, "Not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these." What plant was he speaking of?
Lily.
The lilies.
Exactly. Now, this one's going to be harder, but not impossible. Number five is the tale of the behemoth mentioned in Job chapter 40 was like what tree?
I want to say cypress, but
close.
Is it like I was thinking it was more like the dawn of what is it they call the redwood, you know, the new dawn, the redwood tall sequoia type trees.
No, those weren't over there, but it's the name comes from a country, or is part of the name of a country north of Israel.
Well, those cedars of Lebanon.
Right, it's a cedar, yeah. It didn't say cedar of Lebanon, right, but it does say cedar.
Right.
Also in Job chapter 40, verses 21-22, when we're speaking of the behemoth, it says, he lies under the locust trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The blanks by the brook surround him. What plants surround him? I'll give you a hint. It is a type of tree.
I was going to say palm, but...
Sue?
No. Say the last part again.
Verse 22 says, the lotus trees cover him with their shade. The blank, and it's a tree, by the brook surround him.
A willow?
Oh, good job. Yep, the willows surround him. And some versions said poplar, but that one might need a little bit further research. Now we're going to Isaiah 55 for number 7. It speaks of a time when things will get better for the followers of God. Using plants to demonstrate this instead of, and they first of all talked about the bad things that were happening, and they were described as thorns and briars coming up. But when things get better for God's people, they're going to be replaced by two plants. What are those plants?
And where is this found again?
These plants represent things improving. So what's coming up instead of thorns and briars? This was in Isaiah 55. They're trees.
Instead of stones.
They're trees.
Well, that helps.
And one has been mentioned already.
Oh, so maybe like the cedar and the oak or something like that.
It's not the cedar. Tom said it earlier.
I got to remember what I said.
Oh, the palm tree.
No, starts with a C.
You said it wasn't a cedar.
The cypress tree.
Cypress.
Remember when you said cypress?
That's right.
And also the myrtle.
Cypress and myrtle.
Oh, the myrtle. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd forgotten about the myrtle.
Now we're going to jump over to Zechariah chapter 1, verse 8 to 10. He says, I saw at night, and behold, a man was riding on a red horse, and he was standing among what type of trees, which were in the ravine? We've already mentioned this, too.
My favorite tree is a cypress, so...
No, the myrtle.
Myrtle.
It was myrtle. All right, so I beat you up pretty good with the Bible questions. Let's go with something a little different. What is the heaviest fruit in the world, according to the Guinness World Book of Records? Now, remember, a fruit is the result of pollination and fertilization.
Is it a coco de mer?
No, let me give you another hint. The world's record of this fruit is 2,702 pounds. Weighs more than a Nissan Micra car.
A fruit that weighs that more
really
than
should
that.
Do it for you.
Really?
Yeah, 2,700 pounds? Come on now.
Trying to think of something that big.
Think of the earlier hint that I gave you. Anything that's a result of pollination and fertilization is considered a fruit. So a tomato is considered a fruit.
Maybe it's a pumpkin.
There you go. I would have had to slap you in the face with that last
one. That's right. Just
after. There's it's nothing. Like those,
no
those,
other fruit
those
get that
in
big.
The gourd.
Yeah, that's it.
Especially since we processed about 17 pumpkins and I forget how many, 54 or whatever. So, I mean, we did a lot of pumpkin and a lot of squash this year.
And Gary, we're going to recommend something to you. One of them is a heritage variety or heirloom variety. I got the idea from an article in Birds and Blooms, and I got the seeds. And the first year didn't work because of either ground squirrels or non-irrigation. But this year, Tom was successful. I got the seeds again. He was successful. We made it into pumpkin pies for Thanksgiving dinner. And everybody declared it was the best they'd ever had.
And what were they?
They were called Blue Jarredales. Oh, they're kind of a Cinderella.
Yeah, I know what they look like. Yeah,
And they have a blue skin, and they taste wonderful.
Yeah, there are a lot of squash out there that are absolutely delicious. So I have, I don't know if I've tasted it, but I've seen it before.
Oh, it's really good. And the recipe, I'll have to send it to you. But it turned out almost like a custard, didn't it, Tom?
Yes, it was delightful. We have two left, so maybe we'll gift you one of them after the Strong Tower Radio Christmas party.
Okay, are you using them for decorations?
No.
Okay, here's the next one. What is the longest fruit in terms of length in the world? Not something that you would normally think of.
Hmm. Length, huh?
I'll give you a hint. It's named after a person. Probably not really named after a person, but a person's name is part of the name.
It's probably something like Caesar or something like that.
Oh, Tom, I like that idea.
No, that's not it. Oh. Do you know? All right, I'll give you another hint.
It sounds like it would be like a long, skinny squash or something.
No, my sister used to play this game with me and beat me all the time where I was bouncing a ball and trying to pick up these metal...
Jackfruit.
That's right. It's jackfruit.
I've seen jackfruit over in India, and it grows very prolifically, and it's used for many things.
You can buy it in the Lansing area, too.
Oh, yeah.
I've never tasted it, but I'm going to.
I've never seen it long and skinny. I've only seen jackfruit round. You know, that green, frumpy, funny skin, you know? And then you crack it open,
I didn't say long and skinny. I just said what was the longest fruit, which it was 22.5 inches long, just a little bit short of 2 feet long. That's a pretty big fruit.
Wow.
Okay. Now this
I thought the Coco de Mer at 40 pounds usually was a large thing. In fact, they're not very common, but in the rare groves of them, I know that people can't walk there because can you imagine if a 40-foot coconut hit you on the head?
Yeah, it could kill you.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one is, what is the smallest known fruit in the world?
Smallest known fruit.
Has it got something to do with a fig because they have those funny inflorescent flowers, so they're so tiny?
No. Tom, you want to try?
I'm clueless.
It's called the Asian watermeal.
Okay.
It comes from the Asian watermeal plant, and it has the world's smallest known flower and fruit. But it's something that you might want to try because it has 40% protein content. It's eaten as a vegetable, and it's said to taste something like sweet cabbage. And the native region where you would find this would be in Asia, parts of the Americas, and Africa. So it actually comes from a duckweed. It's a type of duckweed. And if you know anything about duckweed, they're extremely tiny.
Oh, yeah, because remember that was the world's smallest flowering plant in one of our former quizzes.
Yeah, yeah. And of course,
and you can watch the ducks actually eat it.
Yeah, when you have a flower, you'll get fruit. If it's pollinated and fertilized.
So what is the size of this world's smallest fruit?
They didn't really give information in terms of how small it was, but it probably is going to be measured in millimeters. Because duckweed is extremely small. It's only a few millimeters.
It's only a teeny little weed.
Yeah.
Like a leaf floating on the water. It's so tiny you could... The only way you see it is if there's a bunch of it, and it makes a floating raft on the water.
Right, and it doesn't look all that appetizing. But I guess it's really packed with vitamins and minerals, so... I'd have to be really hungry. But I'll remember that next time I get into a famine situation.
So you've got to have more than one of them to make them...
Yeah, you're going to need a bunch.
It's like eating one blueberry, but much smaller.
Yeah. The next one is, and I think this is the last one, what food plant or crop, and there's actually, it's a class more than just one particular one, is the most, produces the most allergic reactions in the world? Food plant.
Besides peanuts.
Peanuts comes in at number 4.
Oh, really?
It's not the number 1.
And I thought everybody was having the reaction to wheat.
Wheat is in the list too. Wheat's down at number 6.
That's interesting. Is it a crop that's grown globally or?
Yeah, in certain areas. Let me just tell you, it's tree nuts.
Tree nuts.
So number 1 is cow's milk. Number 2 is eggs, but the first plant-based allergens that cause the most trouble in the world are the tree nuts. So that would be things like almonds and pistachios, that kind of thing.
So are all these nuts, tree nuts, have the same allergic potency effect?
Probably not, because allergies can be very individualized. One person can have a real reaction, and you can also grow out of them. Because when I was young, I was allergic to strawberries and citrus, and I ate it anyway, but I kind of suffered, and I grew out of it. So there's a lot of variables there.
And there's so many, though, now that you say that, because there's almonds and pecans and walnuts and cashews and Brazil nuts and on.
Now, filberts, they don't grow on a tree so much. It's more like a bush. So they wouldn't be included with that.
Well,
still, it's a problem, I would think. How interesting.
And by the way, you shouldn't give your pets tree nuts either. It's not good for them.
Well, very good.
Oh, good to know.
Well, that...
Kitty, no more almonds for you.
Oh, stop doing that. Yeah, we found out later that our first poodle, who used to love avocado, that's not something that you should feed a dog. So anyway, onions either.
Well, that was the first ever of the untitled surprise quiz.
I'll go back to a theme next month.
Okay, thank you. Well, listeners, you've been observing the... Good Growing with the Garden Guy, the quiz that we traditionally have had for the last year or so, and we'll be back after this break.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you, and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
Welcome back to Good Growing with the Garden Guy. I'm your host, Tom Majeur, with my sister, Sue.
It's good to be here.
And, of course, it wouldn't be the show without the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig. He's a retired horticulturist from Michigan State University, and we have the privilege of exclusively having him here on Strong Tower Radio.
Yeah, I'm retired from MSU, but I'm still doing stuff.
All right. You always keep you involved, and part of the things you do is with Good Growing with the Garden Guy. We appreciate you.
And, of course, my YouTube channel. And
yes.
Sometimes I do presentations for different groups. So.
And we're going to be talking about your YouTube channel in this next section. Hey, Gary, just one thing, experience that I had. I have three active apple trees, and I had made them and boiled them down to apple juice with my wife and I, and that was very, very labor intensive. And this year, a friend had a apple cider press. He had an apple grinder and an apple cider press, and in 3 hours, I processed over 17 bushels of apples and got 24 gallons of apple cider. That was just plain fun.
It is, but don't drink too much at one time.
Oh, really?
Apple cider can act as a laxative if you drink too much. So
that was probably after the second or third day I noticed that.
Yeah. It'll keep you regular.
But it's a lot less work to do it as an apple cider press than to do it
Now, if you were a grower, you wouldn't want to do that to your apples because you make most of your money selling them retail and then less money if you're selling them wholesale. And a lot less money when you're juicing them.
I tell you what, I was at Meijer just this morning before the show, and 3 pounds of Macintosh apples are $5.29.
Yeah, and if you buy some of the latest cultivars like Cosmic Crisp, for instance, you're paying by the apple. And you might pay, and they can get quite large. You might pay $1.50, $2 just for one apple.
Yeah. It's,
then if you put a little caramel on it and some chocolate, some nuts, then
like
it goes
five,
up to seven.
Five, seven, whatever. Yeah, so.
That's called a value-added product.
That's right. Well, let's talk about, I understand we're going to talk about fruit damage and how to salvage the trees through pruning. I think you had some challenge with that in the Lansing area earlier this year.
Oh, yeah. I had trees down all over the place. And as you drive around Michigan, for instance, when I was coming down 115 and I was pointing out to my wife all the trees that were just uprooted by the winds. But we have a pear tree that was just devastated. And one of the things I'm going to do is a video on the corrective pruning to see if it's worth keeping. Most likely it would be, but one of the options that I have, and I'm going to try this, is after I finish taking out all the dead stuff and getting it pruned, and I'll go through the steps in a second, I'm going to do what's called top working on the tree, which is essentially grafting other varieties onto that tree.
And why are you doing that?
For fun.
Oh, for fun. You have too much time on your hands being retired.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I mean, just think of this. Instead of having, say, 10 pear trees, you could have one pear tree and graft a bunch of varieties onto it. And you'll still have one tree, but all different types of pears. Or if you wanted to do this with plums or peaches or anything else, apples, you could have many varieties on just one tree.
Did the storm damage open up parts of that tree? When you're doing this pruning, what type of pruning are you doing?
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is remove all the broken branches. And the tree was probably 25 feet tall. It's probably down to about 18 now because it snapped off the top limbs.
Okay.
So all of those and some side limbs were knocked off. So the first thing I need to do is take off everything that has been snapped in half. And then I take a look at the tree and see what I have left. And then I go through taking out all the unproductive wood, which is what you would normally do in a pruning year, which would include water sprouts, which are those vertical branches that grow off a side branch, which mess up the look of the tree also. And the suckers, if you happen to have a fruit tree that produces suckers, which are the straight limbs that are growing up from the root system, need to be taken out. Also,
That's on the ground.
They come from the root system, yeah, around the base of the tree. And another thing that I'm going to want to do is thin out the branches so that I can get better air circulation and light penetration, which will have an effect on what we call the finish of the apple. And when you open a tree up, it also decreases diseases because the leaves and the fruit can dry off faster when wind can move through the tree. And then another thing I'm going to try to do is make sure that I take out branches that are shading other branches. So I'll take the one that is exposed to the sun the most and get the other one out, because that'll have an effect on the quality of the fruit too. And then finally, if possible, depending on what you've done in the past with your pruning, you want to taper the tree so that the lowest branches are the widest out, and then it tapers more toward the middle trunk as you move up. So,
you're
sort
more
like
aggressive.
The shape of a Christmas tree.
You're more aggressive, and you're looking for a smaller diameter of the tree. As you go up.
It's sort of like the taper of a Christmas tree, but not that significant. And the reason for that is just so that you get good light penetration throughout the tree from the top branches to the lower branches. Because naturally, if you don't do that, as the tree gets older, the top branches become the dominant branches, and you'll get an umbrella appearance to your tree, and all those lower branches will be so shaded that they'll die out.
And it brings up the question, when I was harvesting my apples, you talk about shading, but sometimes access to the branches, sometimes they were so thick that you couldn't penetrate into the tree in order to grab the apples that you were trying to pick.
Mm-hmm. And it's also difficult when you're trying to treat for insects and diseases too, because if the canopy's too thick, you don't get good penetration of what you're spraying. So it could affect the quality of the fruit in that way.
Absolutely.
It sounds almost as complicated as doing topiary.
Not quite that bad. But I'll be doing a video, because I'm going to do this step by step as I do the corrective pruning and see what it looks like when we're finished. I'll be starting that probably January if the weather stays nice.
Well, Sue used a term, Jelaine Fenner always makes us define everything. So topiary
is what you see when you go down to Disney World, when they shape your bushes to look like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, or they might make it look like a larger version of, what do they call the little miniature trees? I'm having a senior moment.
Bonsai,
yeah.
You know, it's interesting, when we were in Mexico, along some of the avenues in certain areas, they would shape the trees to be rectangular, or it was quite...
Well, but true topiary isn't just turning it into squares or circles. That's more of a formal way of pruning. Topiary is when you start making shapes. They may be geometric shapes. They might be, like I said, cartoon characters or whatever. But
or even a spiral or something.
Yeah, spirals, things like that. But the thing is, when you do that, it's pretty work intensive, and you have to keep doing it.
Okay. Now, next subject that you have on the list here is El Nino, and I think you talked about it in the previous program.
We talked about it a little bit. It's shaping up to be a good El Nino year, because this week, in December when we recorded this, the temperatures are in the 50s. So that will allow you to get outside, and if you haven't cleaned up your garden, which I haven't cleaned up mine yet, you can get out there and pull up your landscape fabric and the tomato cages and get the weeds out and get your compost pile started. It's still warm enough to do some of those things, and that may hold into January. You can never predict Michigan weather. I'm sure we're going to get some snow, but with an El Nino year, you get less snow. In our area. In other areas, they'll get more snow.
So for our listeners, and just to make sure I'm thinking on the right path, is El Nino warmth, or is it lack of precipitation?
El Nino is what it actually is a warming of the Pacific Ocean waters off the west coast of the United States. It's kind of like a line going all the way across the Pacific. And because of that, it changes the Gulf, Gulf Stream. And so the Gulf Stream are these real high, fast-moving winds that direct our storm systems during the winter months. And so they don't go the same pattern that they usually do. So in the case of this El Nino, you'll see more winter storms go further south, and you'll see things happening in the east. But in the Great Lakes states, we generally have warm and drier weather, which means you get outside more and do some gardening.
Okay.
Well, not so much gardening, but cleaning up.
Well, if we get a La Nina year, what happens in the Great Lakes?
Well, we tend to get a little bit more precipitation that year. Now, in mid-Michigan, we are away from the lake far enough so that we don't get as much lake effect snow. But they'll get more snow toward the coastal areas. The lake effect goes in about 20 miles, if I remember correctly. But we do have a little bit more snow on those years, and we usually have colder years. But it's not like the 60s. When we were growing up in the 60s, boy, we got some good snowstorms.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen a good one here in what, since about 78? And I'm talking about the ones where you get almost 3 feet of snow and drifts that are 6 feet high.
It shuts everything down.
Oh, yeah. It's. I still have some 8mm film of one in the 70s, I think 78, and our car was essentially buried.
Mm.
It's pretty cool to watch.
So under El Nino, you put the word winter yard work. Did you?
Well, winter yard work means you can get out there and prune and be a little bit more comfortable as we get into January and February. Cleaning up, especially if you still have damage from the storm. I have so much damage, it'll probably take me to late summer to get that all done. It's just too much. I have trees down all over the place. And, of course, you can go out in an unheated garage and do things, working on your sharpening tools and maintenance on your lawnmowers and rototillers and wood chippers and all the different things that we use to make life easier. And so we never know what Michigan's weather is going to be, but there's a pretty good forecast that we'll be outside more. My wife, for instance, she had gotten some bulbs and hadn't planted them. She just planted them this week because the ground hasn't even frozen yet. So, and she asked me about that, and I said, it's better they're in the ground because they're not going to do anything but dry out and die if you don't plant them. If you can't get them in the ground, at least put them in a pot.
Mm-hmm. What about, you mentioned your YouTube video earlier. Want to give us an update?
Well, right now I'm doing the series of the new All-America selections that we'll talk about in a minute. But so far I have a celosia called Burning Embers posted and a pepper called Red Impact. And there were two broccolis that won an All-America selection this year. One was called Skyline and the other Purple Magic. And I already have the Siam Gold up there, which is a new marigold for 2024.
Are these more of a description, or have you actually planted them? And
No, they won't be released until next year.
Oh, okay.
Now, some of them you can get the seed now, because when I was doing these earlier videos, it said available soon. But now you can get some of these. And I also did a relaxation video, so when you've had a hard time in the garden, for instance, or working in the yard, I did a relaxation video where you can watch the waves come in on Lake Superior. These are calm waves, so I want to go back and do another one when they're big waves. And I don't know if I mentioned this in past programs or not, but I did a relaxation video on butterflies and hummingbirds.
So yes, I like both of those and the Superior one, too. Yeah. They're both really good.
So those are all to help you deal with stress. Most of the time, people garden to relieve stress. But sometimes when you've been pruning all day and you want to just forget about that, because when I prune, I end up dreaming about pruning. And so I can watch one of those relaxation videos and just fall asleep.
All right. What about, let's move on to organic homemade fertilizer from kitchen scraps.
Now, I always save my kitchen scraps, like peels from apples and bananas, and sometimes you trim off things from various vegetables or fruits that may have a little imperfection. And if it's really wet, I'll put it in my worm composting bin, or I have a circular bin outside. It's a tumbler. But one of the things I'm playing with right now is I dry out a lot of this stuff, like the apple peels and the potato peels and eggshells. And then I put them in a blender. It's actually a chopper grinder. And I turn it into a powder. And of course, there are nutrients. There are lots of nutrients in the peels of things. And they're the same things that the plants need. And if you ever think about it, nobody fertilizes a forest. They just recirculate those nutrients. When the leaves fall, they decompose, and the roots pick up those nutrients again the next year. And that's why the forest floor, when you dig down in there, it looks like a big peat bog or compost pile. And so instead of throwing all this stuff away, what I would do is I'd put it on a tray, put it in the oven for about a half hour at about 350 degrees so it's nice and crispy, and then I put it in the blender or the chopper and turn it into a meal, and then I will be using that as a natural fertilizer. And so I'm going to do some videos where I use this and then use nothing and see how that turns out. So that'll be one of the videos I'll be making during the winter months. And I'll also make one that'll show you how to do this. And I just don't like to waste all these things. I always used to teach people, don't send any organic matter off your property. Find a way to use it.
Retain it.
That's right.
Let's talk about growing green leafy plants, greens indoor.
This is something that I'm going to try too. I have all kinds of plant lights in my house. I have the LEDs, which are light emitting diodes. Those are the latest thing. And then I have fluorescents. I have the regular T7s, which would be like a shop light, and T5s, which are the smaller bulbs, but they're high energy and lower energy use. And so what I'm going to do is I saw this boot mat that was sold by Home Depot, and it was about an inch and a half deep, and it was just perfect for growing a tray of light rooting plants. So I'm going to use a potting soil, use one of my LED lights, and plant spinach and lettuce and other leafy greens and grow them in the house. And then, of course, you can snip them with scissors, and then if you don't cut the growing points, they'll just continue to grow all winter. And it's for those people who are really frustrated that they can't get outside. Now, the economics of it, I might calculate that, but the lighting cost can add up if you're using something like what I call electric hog, like a electricity hog, like a T7 shop light. They will use a lot more, or some of the incandescent growing lights will use a lot more energy. But you can calculate exactly how much energy it would take if you want to.
You just call it therapy.
Yeah. Everybody has a hobby. Mine are pretty cheap compared to, you know, some of the things that people do.
Well, very good. You've been listening to The Garden Guy, Gary Heilig. The program is Good Growing with The Garden Guy. Your hosts are Tom and Sue Majeur. We'll be back after this break.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with The Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, your hosts Tom and Tom and Sue Majeur. My wife is at home, but my sister is here. And Gary started a nice series here about plant nutrients, and we're already down to the Z's. We're down to zinc.
Well, I'm not doing them in alphabetical order.
Okay.
I'm doing it more by how do I feel today?
Oh, okay.
And it was kind of a zinc-y day.
Okay, so this is zinc month. So what is zinc? I know that there's a zinc. You have aluminum and zinc. Those are two alternatives for light metals, non-metallic metals. But is this the same zinc?
Zinc is zinc. It's an element that you'd find on the periodic table. And it is considered a micronutrient for plants, which means that they require it in very small amounts. And to give you an example, if I made a recommendation for nitrogen in a vegetable garden, I might say you're going to need to put down 3 pounds per 1,000 square feet for the whole season of a particular material. And it's a lot more complicated than that, but let's just use that as an example. Whereas if you were going to use zinc, you might use 2 pounds on an entire acre, which is 43,560 square feet. So a micronutrient is a nutrient that's needed in very small amounts compared to the macronutrients, which are things like nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium.
Those are the big three.
What does it do? Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. There are a number of things it does, and the first one is kind of geeky. If you remember what an enzyme does, it helps to make reactions happen. And what it does is it activates these enzymes, which are responsible for the plant. It helps to make proteins. Another thing it does, it helps in the formation of chlorophyll, which is the way a plant makes carbohydrates, or the simple word for carbohydrates would be sugars. And examples of those would be glucose, fructose, sucrose, starches, and a starch is a carbohydrate. And another thing that it's used, it helps starches to be converted to sugars in fruit. So when you go out and grab an apple late August, well, let's say mid-August, and you taste it, it'll have a different feel in your mouth. And that's because it's a high starch level at that point. So zinc plays a role in helping those starches, which is one type of carbohydrate, into the sugars that we want. Like the, in this case, fructose is the big one in fruit. And another thing that it does is it helps plants to withstand cold temperatures better.
Really?
So if you have a zinc deficiency in your soil, then you're more likely to get cold weather injury on your plants. And, of course, just looking at your plants, you can't tell what the situation is. But not all plants respond the same to zinc. For instance, apples benefit from applications, edible dry beans, corn, onions, snap beans, and sweet corn, not only field corn, but sweet corn. So you'll get a more of a response if you use zinc on those. Now, for grapes, lettuce, tomatoes, soybeans, did I say tomato? You get a moderate response. In other words, it doesn't change things that much. And then you'll get a small response for things like asparagus or carrots or peas. And then things like sunflowers, beets, and things like that. So even though you're adding zinc, they don't need it so much. And the only way you can determine whether your soil is deficient in zinc is to run a soil test. And it used to be an extra test, but with MSUs now, the way they're doing it, it might be included. They might have included certain micronutrients in their test, but I don't recall off the top of my head. But when you have a deficiency, usually it depends on the type of crop that you have in terms of what kind of symptoms you're going to see. For instance, with corn, you'll get striped yellow leaves, but on beans, you'll just get a yellowing of the leaves that are older, which will be lower on the plant. But there are many other things that could cause that type of situation. So that's why a soil test is important to be able to rule out or to diagnose if you have a deficiency or not.
Does it respond if, let's say you get the test and you're low in zinc, is it too late already, or will the plants respond that season?
they can respond that season depending on how you put the zinc on, and we'll talk about that in a second. But the other thing that you can do to improve the quality of the zinc or have zinc in your soil is to add compost to the soil. And especially if you're adding animal manures, animals do not use all the nutrients that they take from food. So it goes out the back end and it ends up in compost. So another good source would be worm castings, or you can buy what's called zinc chelates. It's a special form of zinc, which is dissolvable in water, and you can spray it right on the plants if you need to. And if you do that early in the season, you'll get a response right away. Or you can add zinc sulfate to the soil, and you can also add chelates to the soil. But I wouldn't do that without getting recommendations for it on a soil test, because you can add too much zinc to your soil. Because a lot of times when I used to deal with homeowners, they say, well, if this much is good, then twice that much is much better. Now, that's not always the case, especially for a micronutrient where you don't need very much of it. So it can cause some toxicity problems with the plants, and it depends on the plant. But also, when you're getting a soil test, you want to watch your phosphorus levels, because if your phosphorus levels get too high, then you're going to have a problem with plants taking up zinc, even though there might be sufficient zinc in the soil. So that's why it's good to have a soil test. And phosphorus is one of these minerals that, or nutrients that, when you put it in the soil, it doesn't move very fast. So it'll build up in your soil over time. And so you have to keep a watch on that.
Phosphorus, does that have any correlation to some of the fertilizers that are used? What builds up?
That phosphorus is the second nutrient that you find in a fertilizer bag. So if you're going down to the garden center and you're buying a bag of 12, 12, 12, that first number represents how much nitrogen is in the bag. The second one is how much phosphorus is in the bag. And the third one is how much potassium is in the bag. And it's expressed as a percentage of weight. Okay. So 12 means 12% of the weight of that bag is actual nitrogen.
Now, looks like our next subject we're going to look at, it will be pesticides, organic pesticides. So.
Yeah, this is another thing that I wanted to do. Many times people want to grow things organically, but they don't really understand how to use some of these things. For instance, there's a product called Dipel that it's for a group of insects called a Lepidoptera, which is a fancy word for the larva of butterflies and moths. And this material, when you spray it on a plant, they ingest it, and there's an endotoxin that gets into the digestive system, and they get sick and die. But when people apply it, they think that it works as long as, say, 7 or malathion, but there's biodegradation of this stuff, and when it's exposed to sunlight, it breaks down in about 3 days.
Mm.
So that isn't on the label. And so that's why I wanted to go over some of these organic products and tell you some of the details about them that'll help you to use them.
How do you spell that?
Spell what?
The one you just gave us.
Dipel? It's D-I-P-E-L. That's it's a bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis. We've talked about it before. But there are a number of names. Thuricide is another one. Impede is another one. These are all Bacillus materials. But insecticidal soaps are just that. They're soaps. They are potassium salts of fatty acids. Now, you have to get into chemistry to understand what that means, but that's exactly what soap is. It's made by combining fats or oils with an alkali material such as lye. And so what they do is they use plant oils and what they call, potassium salts. And they combine these to make these materials. Probably, I may not have all that correct, but most people couldn't care less how it's made. They just want to know if it's going to work. And what it does is it basically desiccates certain types of insects.
That dries out.
Dries out, right.
Dehydrates.
Yeah, I was going to
Okay.
I was going to do that because sometimes you use all these technical terms. People say, what is this dude talking about? But anyway, it dries them out. It kind of washes away that protective coating because they have a hard protective coating called a cuticle. And it kind of dissolves that. And it exposes the inner tissues to the environment. And, of course, they dry out and stop functioning and the insect dies. But it doesn't work on everything. It's most effective on what we call soft-bodied insects, like aphids, for instance, or spider mites, or thrips, white fly, mealybug. Those are all soft-bodied insects. But if you were trying to spray it on, say, a regular fly, like a apple maggot or blueberry maggot, or beetles like the Colorado potato beetle, not going to work. Asparagus beetles, it won't touch them.
And what we're talking about is the insecticidal soaps.
Insecticidal soaps. And, of course, it's the type of thing, it's a contact poison. It has to contact them in order for it to kill them. Because if it's not on them, it's not going to have any effect. So you have to make sure that you cover everything well when you're spraying it. And it doesn't have any residual, which means that once it dries, then the insects can just crawl all over the place and it's not really going to bother them that much.
So in the dry form, it has no potency.
It's best to hit them directly. And that way you can get them. Now, it's not safe to use on all plants either. People think that, oh, it's organic, it's safe to use on anything. You want to avoid peas and cucumbers and beans in your vegetable garden because they don't like it. They're a little sensitive to it. It is considered an organic product, so you're good there. And it's useful. I've used it for on my house plants. It's the one thing I go to when, for instance, on my lemon tree, if I see that I have young scale on there, the ones that have not had a chance to build up that waxy coating to protect them, when the crawlers are out, the very young scale, insecticidal soap will kill them.
Is a scale a bug?
It's an insect, yeah.
What does it look like?
It looks like a bump on your branch. Some will be brown and fairly large. They can be maybe 3/8 of an inch across.
But it's actually an insect.
It's an insect, but as that insect matures, it will lose its legs, and then it settles down and puts a little stylet, like a mosquito, into...
Bores right into it.
Yeah, right into the phloem layer, pierces would be a better word, and then they suck out all those juices, all those sugars that the plant's producing, and as it does that, it excretes a material that makes a waxy coating over it, and that as that waxy coating builds up, then insecticidal soaps or no other insecticide will work. At that point, you have to use what's called a systemic that gets into the phloem layer. And so when they're drinking the juice from the plant, they're getting the insecticide too.
And what plants does the scale tend to?
Oh, the scale will get on fruit trees, ornamentals. You can get them on certain house plants. Same thing with aphids. You'll see them all over the place. Mealybugs you'll get on a wide variety of plants too. So it's a nice low toxicity insecticide that can be used indoors and outdoors. You don't have to worry about it making your dog or your cat sick. It doesn't have a terrible smell. So it's a very useful insecticide.
It's not toxic to humans.
No. I mean, no, it's not likely. Even if you got some on your skin, no, it wouldn't. You'd want to wash it off because it won't feel comfortable, but it's not going to cause you any sickness.
What if you use it on your lawn and a robin comes by and eats a worm?
No, not going to be a problem, but you wouldn't use it on your lawn because the kind of insects that are a lawn problem are not soft-bodied insects. So now you'd have something like sod webworm, which it might cause them some trouble, but most of the time they're not going to be where you can get at them. So it just doesn't make sense to use it on sod webworm. And of course, grubs, which are soft bodied insects too, it might have some effect on them, but they're below ground, so you can't get to them either. So there's no reason for you to use an insecticidal soap on a lawn.
Okay, good to know.
Okay, during the winter, deer and rabbits go foraging, and that has, they damage plants?
Well, one of the reasons I put this in here is the good news is, since we have very little snow right now, then they have more to forage on. And at this time of the year, you're probably going to see less damage on ornamentals, unless you're out someplace where there's not much around and they just come to your house, like if you're living out in the country somewhere. But what people will do, say, for instance, if you have ewes that they like to feed on, you can put up physical barriers like burlap, covering the plants, that type of thing. It doesn't look very nice, but it can solve the problem of having them feed. There's certain things. I have a giant thuja in my yard that they like to feed on the lower ends of it. You could put burlap around that, and they only feed up so high. So you put the burlap up as high as they're feeding, and that solves that problem. And also, they will feed on young fruit trees, so you want to put a cage around the young fruit trees so that they're not feeding on them. But right now, you're okay. But if we start getting cold weather with a lot of snow, which I'm not expecting this year, they start to get more desperate, and they'll come looking for your trees.
You talked about burlap bags. I think it was the... Is it the box elder plant? You need to protect it from the frost and the desiccant. And I thought that's why you put burlap bags on.
So. You don't want to protect the box elder at all. You might be thinking of box wood or something else.
Boxwood, I'm sorry.
Now, there are two things you can do. When something is in the wind and you put a barrier there, it does help to slow down the loss of water because you don't have that material being exposed to the moving winds. But they're also anti-wilt materials. One is called Wilt Proof that you can spray onto a plant this time of year, and then it will also help to avoid the loss of moisture, and then you wouldn't have to put up the barrier if you're not having problems with deer.
Is this readily available at all garden centers?
Wilt-proof, if you have some of the nicer garden centers, you'll probably see it. But, of course, anything can be bought online now. So
right.
I'm sure Amazon will be happy to ship it right to your door.
Your box stores such as Meijer and Walmart, would they have that out of season?
No, usually they'll start bringing those things in toward the fall when they're going to need it, because a store doesn't want to waste shelf for something that nobody wants right now. So... I have seen Wilt Proof in some of the big box stores, but it's not always there. Mm-hmm. So,
well, that kind of concludes our program for January of 2024. I'm your host, Tom Mazure, with Sue Mazure, and your subject matter expert has been Gary Heilig. He's a retired horticulturist from the Michigan State University, and we talk about growing things every month, the second week of the month, as much as possible. And so stay tuned for next month, or go on our website in the archives, and you can hear recordings. There's a special section there for all the past programs from year to year. And, of course, you can go to Gary's YouTube channel. He's mentioned that several times during our program as Gary Heilig, Heilig.
Right.
Yeah. Gary Heilig, and enjoy. Until next month, I'm your host, Tom Mazure, for Strong Tower Radio. Bye now.